KBOO Community Radio is proud to be the sponsor of the 28th Annual Waterfront Blues Festival, taking place from July 2nd through the 5th at Waterfront Park in Portland. The Blues Festival includes cruises like the Blue Bayou Cruise, the Rock the Boat Dance Cruise, Drifting Blues Cruise, and the Sail On Sister Cruise, as well as after-hour performances featuring Galactic, Charmaine Neville, Big Bad Voodoo Daddy, and the Paladins. Again, that's the 28th Annual Waterfront Blues Festival, Thursday, July 2nd through Sunday, July 5th at the Waterfront Park in Portland. For more information, go to kboo.fm/waterfrontbluesfestival2015.
Cascadia. Today is Monday, June 22nd, 2015, and you're listening to KBOO Portland, your community radio at 90.7 FM, kboo.fm on the web. Today's guest is Stephen Zunis. He's been a guest on the show in the past, and he returns today to talk about a piece that came out recently in the National Catholic Reporter on the contrast between the fate of Tunisia and that of Libya. This contrast indeed is stark, and if you look at it, barely scratch the surface, you find the fingerprints of America all over the chaos in Libya. When we attempt to eliminate a head of state of a sovereign nation, regardless of whether we agree or disagree with that ruler's policies and actions, nonetheless, this is not the way to go about nation building. Stephen Zunis writes that the people of Libya and Tunisia both overthrew long-standing dictatorships in popular uprisings in 2011. Stephen is on the line waiting. I just want to run through briefly a couple of headlines. Proponents of building the nation's largest rail-to-marine oil transfer terminal at the port of Vancouver will be allowed to intervene in a lawsuit that accuses the port of unlawfully cloaking parts of the lease. This reeks of course, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. It seems that many companies and corporations have already planning for how they plan for what they expect to be able to do, whether or not they're so confident that this thing is going to pass that they're all on point to take advantage immediately. And the leader of the white supremacist group that had been linked to Dylann Roof, the suspect in the murder of 9 African Americans in Charleston last week, has donated tens of thousands of dollars to Republican campaigns, including those of 2016 presidential contenders, the redoubtable Ted Cruz, Rick Santorum, and Rand Paul. WikiLeaks began publishing the Saudi cables. More than 500,000 cables and other documents from the Saudi Foreign Ministry contained secret communications from various Saudi embassies around the world. That's going to be interesting in light of what Stephen Zunis, our guest today, is probably going to speak about. And where were you when why is it always on Friday? FISA, our spy court, has cleared the path to renewing NSA powers. This happened, of course, on Friday. Nobody's paying attention. It's too hot. Too many things to do and places to go. Okay, the secretive federal court that oversees the nation's spies is laying the groundwork for temporarily reauthorizing the NSA sweeping collection of U.S. phone records while you were on the way to the beach. And surveillance for the radiation detected groundwater at Exelon's Peach Bottom nuclear plant. It's all over the place now. Containing it once the genie is out of the bottle seems to be something that we have so far failed to accomplish. And now we want to welcome Stephen Zunis to the KBOO Airwaves. Thanks so much for being with us today, Stephen.
Good to be with you again.
Well, I saw your piece and I was fascinated because this is an issue that I have been thinking about and talking about with various people for quite a while. With the absolute chaos in North Africa and the Middle East, Libya, a disaster. Now we have Syria. We have this WikiLeaks disclosure of the Saudi cables, which should reveal a lot that proved to be very interesting. But the difference between the outcomes when we compare Tunisia and Libya is stark, and it's to me it's obvious that wherever the U.S. intervenes, it is an absolute disaster. Would you talk a little bit about the piece that you wrote? What the points that you make and more on the looking forward. This seems to have generated enormous numbers of refugees from all across that part of the world arriving on European shores, and European nations are completely unprepared to cope with the fallout from American intervention. But Tunisia and Libya, that's what we want to talk about today because they're perfect case examples.
Yes, they're very much so. I mean, you know, there are a number of factors that make these two countries different in their different trajectories, but I would argue that a major factor was the civil war and intervention in Libya, in that we've seen repeatedly, and social scientists have shown this, that when dictatorships are overthrown through armed struggle, 90% of the time they become either new dictatorships or they descend into chaos, like Libya, because you basically... that armed groups see themselves as the vanguard of the revolution. They have this idea of the martial values, strict hierarchy of command and control, and that's sort of how they think things should be run. By contrast, in the majority, certainly not all, but the majority of cases where you've had these nonviolent overthrows of dictatorships, like you have in Tunisia, that in order to build a broad coalition, getting millions of people out in the streets, you got to have some give and take with various groups. You have to build broad coalitions. You have a model of you have a more pluralistic model, and people realize yes, you can make change, even radical change, without the use of arms. And this appears to be what happened in Tunisia, because ironically, in the initial elections following the overthrow of the Gaddafi and Ben Ali regimes, the Libyans actually elected a slightly more moderate government than those in Tunisia. And yet in Tunisia, you know, they had an open enough and democratic enough political system where they were able to bring in more progressive secular elements that eventually ran the government, wrote the new constitution with equal rights for women and religious minorities and et cetera. Whereas in Libya, the democratic elected government was immediately marginalized because you had 200,000 men still under arms and militias not controlled by the government, all in a series of different competing factions that insisted that they were the vanguard of the revolution, that eventually forced the government out, started fighting among themselves, and left this vacuum where Al-Qaeda and ISIS and all these other crazies are now running around taking over. And it's turned out to be a bloody mess, which not only has forced a lot of Libyans to flee to Europe, but because there's no effective government, it's the place in Africa where people from all over Africa could come to try to get on these rickety boats and escape to Europe as well.
Sure, because they've got the launching pad for this massive migration. I thought I was the vanguard of revolution anyway, so I don't understand why they claim to be. So it seems to me that the U.S. has disregarded history and the fact that democracy, American-style democracy, evolved out of history, and a somewhat brief, comparatively, history at that. That it has continued to evolve so that is long past its use-by due date and has turned into this type of capitalism, which is going to eventually consume itself. But so establishing, trying to impose democracy on another nation, wherein, and even if we did understand, even if the State Department did crack a high school history book and read a little bit about these countries, it's still, you can't impose democracy. It has to evolve.
No, in fact, I don't even think that's that much a goal. I mean, most of our arms aid and other support, especially in the Middle East, goes to authoritarian regimes. You know, often our talk of democracy is a fig leaf for, you know, supposing authoritarian regimes we don't like, as opposed to authoritarian regimes we do like. Now, I mean, ideally, you know, the United States would like a country that was stable, democratic, and pro-Western. But if they can't get the pro-Western part, they will prefer a dictatorship. That's why, if you look throughout history, especially during the Cold War, the United States is quite willing to overthrow democratically elected governments.
No problem.
But even if we were to take a more idealistic assumption that indeed we do want democracy, democracy has to be organic. It has to be homegrown. And democracy doesn't necessarily mean free market. It doesn't necessarily mean, you know, supporting this neoliberal worldview. And I think, this is a big surprise. I think a lot of the neocons had in Iraq. They were reluctant to have elections, but they assumed that a democratic Iraq would be a pro-Western Iraq. And guess what? They elect these Shiite parties, which have close ties to Iran. And I remember even during the presidential debate in 2004, one thing that both Kerry and Bush agreed on was that, oh, if we have a democratic Iraq, it will support Israel. I don't think so. There's a degree of naivete along with the more cynical views in U.S. policy. But, you know, at the same time, on the other hand, I want to challenge those who would say, oh, the people in the Middle East aren't capable of democracy, they don't want democracy. You know, we've seen, you know, thousands of people die for the sake of democracy. Liberal democracy may not be the adequate, in my view, to attain social justice, but at least it allows a political opening so that trade unionists, you know, women's groups, peasant leagues, human rights activists, you know, others can mobilize and work for greater social justice. And the fact is that Arabs and the way a democracy takes place in a country will depend on its own unique history and culture, but Muslims and Arabs don't like to be jailed, murdered, and tortured for their political beliefs any more than Western Christians do. And people do want accountable government and social justice, and the vast majority do indeed want democracy. And the best thing the United States can do, if that's what we really want, in most cases, is to stay the hell out of the way.
That's exactly, wherever the U.S. has intervened, that's what we see, and the paradox is Syria, where we of course have made a much over the fact that we haven't like gone dashing in and bombed the hell out of them, but yet still it seems to be an open air arms market that continues, and the degree of intervention in Syria, what is a strange kind of U.S. involvement there? How do you see that? Oh, like we're comparing Tunisia and Libya. If we introduce the Syrian chaos and disaster,
Syria was going to be a much more challenging country for pro-democracy forces to win in, simply because despite everything, the Assad regime still had a social base. Much more so than Gaddafi in Libya, or Ben Ali in Tunisia, or Mubarak in Egypt, and civil society was weaker than in Tunisia or Egypt. I mean, it was the secret police were very strong. It was going to be a hard struggle and a protracted struggle anyway. But despite all that, you know, they continued for 6 or 8 months nonviolently in a broad pro-democracy movement that included people from all different religious groups. And I was actually hopeful for Syria in the long term, but unfortunately, by turning to armed struggle, you end up in this factionalized thing where you have all these foreign countries arming various factions. It gave the Islamists an opportunity, you know, to come and essentially dominate the armed opposition. You've had, instead of the defecting soldiers and the new military units protecting civilians, the civilian death toll has dramatically escalated. And I can never use moral judgment against, you know, oppressed people who feel the need to take up arms, but I think in the case of Syria, I think strategically it was a terrible decision. It just made things worse.
On that note, we're pretty much out of time. I just want to commend listeners' attention to the piece that you wrote. It's in the National Catholic Reporter. You can pretty much find it all over the place. Google Stephen Dennis and the contrasting fates of Tunisia and Libya. That's the article. And then that's about it for today. I want to thank you very much for joining us on Air Cascadia this morning. My guest has been Stephen Zinnes, and we're very, very glad to have him back. Stephen Zinnes is, of course, a professor of politics and the program director of Middle Eastern Studies at the University of San Francisco. Thanks again. This has been Air Cascadia for Monday, June 22nd, 2015. Kate Welch engineered the show for us today. Thanks for that, Kate. Kathleen Stevenson is the KBOOAM News and Public Affairs Director. I'm Chris Andre. Get the facts, know your rights, take a stand. Thanks for listening and stay tuned.
KBOO is a proud sponsor of One Flaming Arrow, an intertribal art, music, and film festival curated by RISE, Radical Indigenous Survivance and Empowerment. This event will take place from June 2nd through the 14th at Surplus Space and multiple venues within Portland.